The following podcast is from the weekly message at Summit Church in Upstate South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
Good morning. Good morning. It's great to see you. It's great to be here. My wife and I, there's a lot of travel going on, and it's a kind of a crisis. Going up 85, everyone has to travel the same two lanes. It's really unfortunate, and my wife and I, we made it all the way to Charlotte without incident, and the day before Thanksgiving, I love the fact, this is one thing I love about technology and what they do with the sales and the Black Friday. Like, Black Friday has made it to Wednesday. It's the weirdest thing. And I love it, though, because my wife and I, we were able to do probably about 75% of our Christmas shopping on Wednesday night over sweet potato pie, preemptory. We were prepping differently than Brett was for Thanksgiving. and so as we were shopping, my heart bleeds all things nerd. And there's this board game. Now, hold on. This isn't Monopoly. This board game is how thick the board game is, and it's this wide, and it's one of the biggest board game boxes you'll ever lay your eyes on. And I have longed for this board game. It's called Gloomhaven, and you're like, that's not very cheery. I know, but this board game is massive, and I've longed for it, but you can guess, like, the size of it, like, the price is just, it's absurd. And it's one of those things. My wife was like, what do you want for Christmas? And I was like, Can I get Gloomhaven for Christmas? And the thing is, like, we're doing our shopping on the Amazon, and we're clicking, and I see she clicks the button, like, it's in the cart, and then the next thing I love about technology, sorry, by the time we got home on Friday, it was there. And it's this huge box, and our kids are like, are those our Christmas presents? I was like, that's my Christmas present. For the first time in a very long time, I get the biggest Christmas present under the tree. I'm very happy. It will affect the size of the Christmas tree because it needs to fit nicely and snugly under there. But this is the thing, though. Like, the notifications, and this is the strange thing being an adult. I was there when my wife ordered it. I got the notification that it had shipped. I saw the money come out of our bank accounts that we earned corporately together. And this is, I see the box. I know it's going to be mine. I know my wife's desire is that I would celebrate in the joy of cracking open the plastic and pulling out the cardboard and looking at the 32-page rule book. And like, I love that stuff. And I look at my wife and I'm like, can I open it? And she looks at me and she's like, no. I was like, but I paid for it, though. And she's like, no. Like, there is something as I get to be an adult and I experience Christmas as an adult, those old fun-spirited arguments that I had as a kid, why do I have to wait? Right? Like, have you ever thought about that? Like, is that board, that silly box is still sitting next to our door because it's too heavy for my kids to move and try to crack open. And it's I can't open it. It's paid for. It's done. The cracking open of the present is sure. And I still have to wait because I love my wife. My wife's she's non-compromising on certain things. And this is one of the things. This idea, though, of waiting in our modern experience is not normal. Like, it is antithetical to the whole mindset of our age, is it not? And it's one thing when we think about the silly things, like when we think about the self-imposed waiting of opening Christmas presents. Like, that's one thing we can laugh about. But this idea of waiting stems to far more serious things, right? Like, when I watch people that I love very dearly struggle with health things, like visiting my father-in-law who lives every single day with shoulder pain. Like watching my friend Jason, I know he jokes about it sometimes from the stage, HIPAA violation, but like his back, like, it's a thing. Like, we all have things in this room that we struggle with on a daily basis, and yet we live in this tension of, I know Jesus is sufficient. Jesus came to deliver me from my pain, and yet the fullness of that isn't experienced. Like, in this time of year, it's not just the pain piece. It's not just the health piece, right? Like, there's legitimate loss that the longer you live life on this little ball of dirt and water, the more loss we experience over time. Like I miss my mom. December 22nd will be 10 years since I've seen her. And there's an absolute promise that has been made that I hold to with all my heart, that I will see her again. That promise has been paid for. That promise is guaranteed, and that promise is not yet experienced, and that is hard. For some of us, the hardship that we experience isn't necessarily maybe a physical thing or a grief, but it's an internal battle that we wage day in, day out, unbeknownst to most. Be it anxiety, despair, addiction. And while intellectually, no matter what our thing is in this room, intellectually we may give assent. It's very easy to give assent. Well, I just, trusting in Jesus, like emotionally, like in our gut, it is really hard at times to grapple with, Lord, I know you have made this promise that you are for my good, and you have made this promise, and you have called me to, in this season, in this moment, to be joyful, but it is really difficult. And walking between the already and the not yet is hard. And this, all of this begs the question that as we approach the Advent season, one thing that we are going to spend the rest of our time thinking well about through the lens of what Scripture says about who Jesus is and what he has done and what he is about to do, it's to process, this morning we get to begin to process this question, how are we to live as a people that wait? Like, what does this word say? What does God have to say to us in this moment and in these times where we have heard these promises, and these promises, we can claim that these promises are true, but it doesn't change the fact that as we wait for the ultimate fulfillment of these promises, it is difficult. And the struggle is real. And for that, I appreciate the words of Isaiah. In the book of Isaiah, I invite you to turn to Isaiah chapter 1. It's where we're going to begin this morning as we look at portions of Isaiah 1 and 2. We think about what it is and how God, as God speaks through Isaiah, what it is to wait. The reason that I personally, as I've been able to spend some time in Isaiah 1 and 2, the past few weeks as I've been studying and meditating on this passage, is that it is easy to think, it is easy to look at the world and to hear the 24-hour news cycle and to almost despair, like the world has never been this bad. Like there's never been any culture apart from our culture right now that's as self-destructive as we are. Like I appreciate, like there's no hope. I appreciate the words of Isaiah 1 as God speaks and as Isaiah reflects on that. Verse 2, listen to the words of Isaiah, speaking the words of the Lord. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. These are the words of the Lord. Children I have reared up and brought up, but they have rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner and the donkey its master's crib, but Israel does not know, my people do not understand. Like the Lord here, as he speaks, the Lord is speaking of the sin and the brokenness that is so profound. It is easy. The way God speaks to his people's rebellion runs contrary oftentimes to the caricature that I have in my mind, that our culture has sometimes in our minds as we think about what is God's response to people's sin. Right? Like, we've all seen the comic strip of God looking at this little computer monitor and someone's doing something bad and there's a big smite button, and God's like waiting with glee to just crush that button and just be like, you deserve this. Like, that's not the tone of the Lord. As the Lord describes the state of his people, there is this profound sense of rebellion. But God speaks of it as the sorrow and pain of a rejected father. His heart bleeds for his people. This is developed further in verse 4. Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity. Now, I don't know what comes to your mind when you think about iniquity. I think in terms of like in my mind, I don't know, there's like the sin. Sin's just like the generic bad things. And then there's like iniquity, which is like, those are the really, really serious things. And that when the Hebrews read this word is really interesting because the word avon, for all the Hebrew scholars, it's this word avon, and it has the idea of, it's not like the really, really bad sins that you go to like hell for. No, avon speaks of, there is a straight path. There is a path that is intended that the Lord has for you. Avon is the idea of, there's a path that is intended to be straight, but it is now bent. And it doesn't just speak to the bentness of a thing that was straight and is now made crooked, but it also speaks to the consequences and the weight of now arriving at a destination you did not intend. And now you have the weight placed upon someone of having to get back. That's why so many times in Scripture it speaks of the weight of iniquity, the weight of a bent path. A sinful nation, a people who are laden with the weight of the path that has been bent. The offspring of evildoers, children who deal corruptly, they have forsaken the Lord, they have despised the Holy One of Israel, they are utterly estranged. Why will you still be struck down? Do you see how his heart bleeds for his people and just the depth of their brokenness? Why will you be struck down? Why will you continue to rebel? The whole head is sick. The whole heart is faint. From the sole of the foot, even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but bruises and sores and raw wounds. They are not pressed out or bound up or softened with oil. You see, the brokenness that is in the world today, God is not a stranger to. The weights of the bent paths that you and I have walked, the weight of the bent paths that generations, that we are feeling the generational impact of in our place today, he's not a stranger to. Like, Isaiah is living in the midst of that. And so the question is, all right, so if this is not a distance increasing holier than thou cry of Isaiah, this is not the bellow of a hateful rage or disdain from God, but rather this is an intimate cry of the Lord for his child who seems to be sprinting off a cliff. And this resonates with me as I think about all of the ways in which my experience, my kids who I love dearly, the people that I love dearly, Greenville that I love dearly, America that I love dearly, the people of the world I love dearly, like the whole thing, the longer I live, it just, the weights of the self-destructive choices that we just seem bent on making. It brings you to a point of just sorrow, and it is easy to get to a place of despair. Like, where is the hope in this? Like, how could the world ever right itself? And then, I just want to touch there as we jump into chapter 2. This is the beginning of the second sermon. And Isaiah, he speaks to the diagnosis of the world. And notice the shift here. He says, listen, but this is what will be. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2. Even though this is what is, verse 2, it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and it shall be lifted up above the hills. First of all, pause here. What is he talking about? What's with the mountain lifting up and the geography shifting? He's not worried about tectonic plates. That's not where he's going with it. Geography class. No. In their world, from the Hebrews reading through the Old Testament, why did mountains matter? It wasn't skiing or went vacation destinations. There was something greater here. When you read through, when you first see the people of God on mountains, what happened on mountains? Like, think through Genesis chapter 9 is one of the first time mountains show up. What's happening? Well, this is where Noah's Ark lands on on Mount Ararat. And who shows up? A God. It's where people and God meet. Right? Like Tower of Babel, why were the people trying to get higher? Because that's where land and God might meet. What about Moses, the next time it shows up? Well, that's Mount Sinai, right? Like that's the mountain is where on earth, that's where we live. We live on earth. And God who dwells in heaven, the mountains are the place where God, heaven, and earth seem to intersect first. Are you with me? So why is Isaiah saying, listen, this is what is going to be, friends. The experience of the people of God is going to be intimate with the Lord to such a degree that we cannot yet comprehend. It's going to be far more pervasive than you can possibly imagine. Like, this is what we have now. We're going to be closer. We're going to experience the nearness and the presence of God in a way we never have. But it's not just the vertical piece. He says, this is what will be, friends. And the nations shall flow to it. And many people shall come together. And this is what they will say. Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, that we may walk his paths. For out of Zion shall go the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations. He shall decide disputes for many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. He speaks to two things, right? Like he speaks to the vertical piece. The people of God shall know God. They shall be with God. But there is also this piece of the people across all nations, the people from all cultures, the natural born enemies that the world would look at and say they are different, they are distinct, we are the chosen of God, they are not the chosen of God. And those people, those ideas will die. And the people of the world will be united. Peace. Friends, peace. Not because one culture will get it right. Not because one people group will finally wage war and suppress all other people groups, which is the habit of humanity for thousands of years. But rather because the king will be here. The king will be here. And there will not be an election, and there will be no scandals, and there will be no sound bites. The king will come, and his rule will be absolute, and the peace and justice that he will bring will flow across the world. No more scandals. no more corruption. Just the good and perfect King who is living amidst his people. And he will call his people to himself, and he will teach his people, and the people will come to him, and the people will learn from him, and the people will take justice and peace back to where they live because they have seen the King. This is the hope. Like, this is what will be. This is not the way the Bible talks about what will be. It's not this vague, generic, rosy, pastel sense of we're going to be in floating in clouds, where with wings. No, this is like very real, like literally earth. And it's spoken as anticipation of what is going to be. Do you understand the difference? Like to give you an example, I remember when Emily was pregnant with our first daughter, there was, in my mind, as a numbskull guy, like I had this idea that there was going to be this child in our home, and then we find out there's a girl. Now I come from a family of boys, and I know there's differences. I knew then there was differences between guys and gals. And I knew there was a difference between having sons and daughters. And I knew life would change just a little bit when we had our first daughter. But it was this vague, generic, like, we're going to have a daughter. It's going to be great. I don't even know what that means other than I'm going to have to pay for a wedding one day. That's pretty much it. Like, that was it. That was all the details I had. And then my wife, she goes to one of these baby showers. And I didn't go. And she comes home, and she is bringing bags and bags of just pink clothes. Like, I did not know there was that many variations of pink until that afternoon. And they're like, I'm sitting in the living room, and I remember this so clearly. I remember sitting in the living room, and she is pulling out, like she's doing the nesting mom thing. Like, she's just like, this is so cute, this is so cute. And I'm just like, it began to dawn on me, I am going to have another human being in my home. Like, this little person that is inside, this person that I love so, so much, like, this is happening. It's not like this maybe. And it turns out, like, in 3 weeks, that little person would decide to come early and change our life forever. But they were coming. And they were going to wear all these various shades of pink. And my life would be wonderfully changed. You see the difference? That shift. And the way in Isaiah 2, it speaks about the kingdom and the King and the radical change it will bring on a personal level for you and I, if you're a child of God, and for culture and for the world and for kingdoms. It is spoken of as reality that is going to play out in the future. This is true. And again, I'm reminded of, so wait, how does this affect us now? Because we live here in the now, right? And it's incredibly easy for us as a people. It's incredibly easy for me as I work on a daily basis to live, love, serve, to try to bring healing where I can, speak truth to call, to extend grace to extend forgiveness to implement strategies to combat injustice, like mostly with the little souls that live in my home now. There's four of them. There's just a whole lot of more injustice. And like, as I try to like just walk in that mess on a day-to-day basis, in the midst of the drudgery of the day-to-day, it is easy to give up to despair. Is that in the midst of the drudgery of the day-to-day grind of living and walking and breathing in the brokenness, it is easy to give lip service to the hope of the future, but while really internally in my heart of hearts, just whatever. And that's not what Isaiah does. Because of, look at what he says, verse 5. I'll just read verse 4 again. It says, he shall judge between the nations. He shall decide between disputes for many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares. Their spears shall be into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift sword against nation. Neither shall they learn at war anymore. What's his takeaway? How does that affect now, the present moment? O house of Jacob, come, imperative. Let us walk, imperative, in the light of the Lord. How does this change? There is the freedom and joy and confidence that we get to walk in the midst of a broken world with a joy that is free from the taint of despair, because we can anticipate a day when the redemption of this world will be made absolute. Not because I'm going to eventually figure it out, not because the works of my hands are eventually going to come to fruition, but because the Lord is going to step in. And this brokenness that we wade in is going to be resolved perfectly. There is no place for despair in the storyline of what God is doing. This is how it affects this moment. And I was thinking through, like, I don't know what your thing is. Like, I'm not sure what you're coping with in this moment. Maybe as you walk in this morning, the thing that lays heavy on your heart is a broken relationship or an addiction, a wound of injustice that has been inflicted upon you, a physical or mental health piece. That is the burden. That is the weight of the bent path that you feel pressed on your soul. And we feel like it is easy. It is easy as we tread this path to get to that despair. And it is easy to come up with various destructive ways to deal with that weight. Like my thing, I have a friend that recently graduated from Clemson with a counseling degree, and I was processing with him how I sometimes process the weight. And I told him, I was like, no, it's very easy for me to just keep things facts and to keep the whole emotional processing thing. Like you put that in a box, just like the Thanksgiving decorations, and you put those in a closet and you save those for another day, not today. That's how I deal with this. And he looked at me and he said, people like you are going to keep people like me employed for a very long time. And he's like, I'll send you my card. The invitation in verse 5 stands in sharp contrast to our petty, frail, insufficient coping mechanisms that we have to walk out of this place. The call and invitation is to walk in the light of the Lord. Right? And there's two pieces to that. The scripture uses the metaphor walk a lot, because it is not the fantastical. Like it's the walking speaks to the one of the most normal things that you and I do in our lives. And he says, no, this is our call. Because even though we live in the midst of a broken and sinful generation, and we have faults ourselves, like we have wounds ourselves, but because of the hope that we have for the future, because of the anticipation for the future that we have, we can with joy walk. It affects, the anticipation of the future affects the normal and mundane routines that we are going to step into this week. The Woodruff Roads, the car lines, oh gosh, the bedtime routines, the diapers we change, the paying of the bills, the financial crisis of today, when we hear that next tragedy that comes out on the news, the hope affects how we step into that. But it's not just the walk, it's let us walk in the lights of the Lord. And again, this isn't just like some meaningless prose where he's like, what should I write? The light of the Lord. No. Like for the Hebrews, when did they walk in the light of the Lord? When did they do that? Because they did that. When did they do it? Like Exodus, they were coming out of Exodus. They crossed the Red Sea. And when was it that the nation, the people of God, what did it mean to walk in the light of the Lord? There was actually a literal light, like the Shekinah glory that shone down from heaven in the middle of the wilderness as they were going where? Where? To the kingdom that he had promised and that they were moving towards. This is what he says. In the middle of the mundane wilderness, as we live as a people in anticipation of the kingdom that is coming, walk in the midst of the mundane near as we pursue the Lord. Walk in pursuit of him, in nearness to him, in the now. This is where the freedom and hope reside. Not that we are going to fix all the problems of the world in the midst of our mundane strategies, but rather because the king that we follow, it has promised, and his promise is sure that as we follow him, he is at work to bring his kingdom to completion in this earth. That's our hope. That is what we anticipate. Lord calls his people to a daily practice and pursuit of him, shaped by his heart for us and his redemption of us as we anticipate his kingdom. And this call, like, what this does, as I reflect on it and as I hear his promise to walk in light of the Lord, like this rips away any sense of apathy. Like I can't justify it. I can't justify building up walls between myself and the brokenness of the world. And I can't justify apathy towards my own harmful, destructive habits that are sinful. I can't do it. Because we're called to walk in light of him. And simultaneously, even though as apathy is being ripped away from me, the call places the burden of bringing the story to resolution. It places the burden of bringing this story and this world to full resolution squarely off of my shoulders. Nope. Removes any justification that I have that it all depends on me. And all of the stress and frustration and anger that is going to follow that. Because the story of redemption in your life does not ultimately depend on us. It depends on the presence and work of the Lord whom we follow. This is incredibly freeing. And that freedom is our only hope. The one who gives the freedom is our only hope. So as we walk into that psychotic whirlwind of a season that is between Thanksgiving and New Year's, and as we all feel the weight to varying degrees, I think about that word again, avon. The bent path and the weight of that bentness. And as I was reading through Isaiah uses that word again in chapter 53, a little bit farther down, as he nears the end of his book, he calls again on the avon. But this is what he says. All of us like sheep have gone astray. The bent path, right? Each of us has turned to his own way. But the Lord has caused the iniquity. The Lord has caused the avon of us all to fall on him. What's your thing? What is your thing that is threatening to break you? That thing has been placed on the shoulders of our King. Because as the story, as we follow the story after the years of Isaiah, the light is becomes, like this is the plot twist, ready? The light that we walk in is not only something that we pursue. The light pursued us. As Josh Garrels wrote in his song, the light came down. The light came down into darkness, as John wrote. There was a light, and the light shone in the darkness. And the light bore our iniquity. And the enemy that would have you believe that there is a weight that you and I are responsible for, it's a lie. He has borne it. He has borne the weight of our bent paths. And that is the King whose arrival we celebrated. We celebrate his arrival and we anticipate his future arrival. Can I invite the band up as we close? If you could, can you take a moment, just bow your heads. And reflect on, like in your heart, take a moment and call out the weight that you might be trying to bear on your own. The weight that threatens to overwhelm, the weight that the King has borne. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he wrote this about the Advent. Look up, you whose gaze is fixed on this earth. Look up, you who are spellbound by the little events and changes on the face of the earth. Look up to these words, you who have turned away from heaven disappointed. Look up, you whose eyes are heavy with tears and who are heavy and who are crying over the fact that the earth has gracelessly torn us away. Look up, you who burdened with guilt cannot lift your eyes. Look up. Your redemption is drawing near. Something different from what you see daily will happen. Just be aware, be watchful, wait just another short moment. Wait and something quite new will break over you. God will come. Lord, lift up my brothers and sisters. Sometimes that weight can feel crushing. And you are sufficient. You are sufficient for the fears of today. You are sufficient for the failure of today. You have borne it. You have arrived. Your presence is here in this moment, and thank you for the hope and joy that we can step back out with joy because of the sure anticipation that you will come. You will bring peace. Lift up my brothers and sisters who may be grappling with that truth. May your spirit speak words of truth and your affection that meets them precisely where they are in this place. Thank you. Amen.
Thank you for joining us for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. For more information about Summit Upstate and other available resources, check out our website at summitupstate.org.